Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and it's time to talk vehicle maintenance with Jim Ward, back with us once again. He's a retired vehicle service manager at Smart Motors Toyota of Madison, worked in the industry for 36 years on all types of cars. We're going to start by maybe talking with him a little about getting water out of your vehicle, and we'll also explain how to prep your car for the cold weather. And, of course, if you're having problems with your car, I hope you will join in. Something going on with the car, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Jim Ward, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good morning, Larry. It's good to be here.
Tell you what, let's talk about flooding. You know, we did this, I forget how many years back, there was a huge rain event, and there were a lot of cars that suffered a lot of damage because of that water.
Oh, 2018. Yeah, it was. I'd never seen anything like it and hope never to again, although I have a feeling Milwaukee probably saw that and worse.
Yeah, it's people like to drive through their water, you know, and if it's too deep, it's probably going to create problems, or it will.
It will, and, you know, even water that just marginally, you know, 6 to 12 inches, you see people driving through it, you know, under low overpasses and things like that. And, you know, many times nothing happened. I mean, the vehicle, the exterior of the vehicle, the engine compartment is made to be splashed and have water when you drive through rain and everything anyway. But there's a great degree of luck. If just in terms of the engine, if just a little bit of water splashes up to the wrong place when you're in that deep water, it can very quickly destroy your motor. And, you know, most of the time, that's not going to happen, but the great risk involved isn't worth it. And a greater risk is the danger of a car being swept away. I mean, you know, if you're in a city and you're seeing other traffic going through, that's one thing, you know. But if you're in the country and you're looking at going over a culvert and water's running over that culvert and you've driven that road before, you know, you can't really be sure that that culvert and there even the pavement is still underneath there. That could have all gotten washed out and you could be driving into a rushing torrent that's just going to haul you away. And even if the road's still there, it doesn't take much more than 10, 12 inches of water to sweep most cars off the path that they're on if it's moving fast enough.
So how does water get into the engine? Maybe explain that.
Well, the engine's intake, typically on most vehicles, is somewhere behind the driver's side headlight. It's an opening that is you know, about the size of a vacuum cleaner's just a couple of inches in diameter, and it's got the suction of a vacuum cleaner. And so if the right amount of water, and it doesn't take much, it's just a couple of ounces, gets sucked into that and sucked into the motor, air and gas that go into the engine compress. Water does not. It might as well be concrete when it goes in there, and that is when engine damage can occur. But that's really not the only way that engine damage can occur either. The other thing that happens and can happen is that your car could be in a parking lot somewhere and the water level could rise high enough to actually allow water to get into that motor. And if, in, you know, without the engine even running, and when you come back to that car, the water may have all run out, you know, and you may be able to see that there was some water here somewhere. But, you know, if you start that motor up in that circumstance, you could very well do engine damage then, too. So if you think or you know that your car sat in a parking lot and got flooded and the water all ran out, do not start the motor. Have the car towed somewhere. The right procedure would be to pull the spark plugs, manually crank the engine over, get that water out before it can damage the engine. So that's another scenario where you weren't even driving the car, but you could potentially have engine damage.
Not a good thing. Jonah in Greenville actually has a story relating to this, I believe. Jonah, hi.
Hi. Yeah, that's true. So last summer we also saw record rainfall. It was kind of crazy right in June. And I had bought a car in April, a new car, and it only lasted me until June because there was a particularly heavy rainfall overnight that without me being in the vehicle, it was while I was asleep, it rose up and flooded from the bottom of the car up through all all sorts of little crevices, and it was like in the carpet.
Sure.
It was everywhere. And I didn't know until, because I was like, well, I closed my windows, so what could possibly, you know,
right.
But I was parked low lying enough by some grass. There's a big parking lot and then a big patch of grass that always gets pretty soaked. So now when I know it's going to rain, I park in the middle of the parking lot instead of by the low lying areas. Cause I don't want that to happen again.
Right. Right. And I mean, even if water doesn't get in your engine, once the interior of the carpet and everything gets soaked and electrical systems like that get soaked, each hour is the greater potential for mold and corrosion in the electrical system and things that would haunt that car the rest of its life. You know, it's a bad situation.
Jonah, thanks for calling and sharing that story. Somebody else is wondering about brakes. How are brakes affected when driving through water?
Well, interestingly enough, of all the things on the car, all the systems in the car, brakes are really minimally affected. Brakes operate under such high pressure. And if you think about it, you'd be driving down the road on a very wet day. Your brakes are constantly being splashed, constantly, absolutely soaked with water, and it really doesn't affect how they work that much. So that is not much of a thing. Surprisingly, the brakes, again, the pressure that they operate is so high and the surface that it friction that it can create is such that water really is not going to have much effect on that. That's one area you probably don't have to worry too much about.
What does it cost if you need to get a new engine?
Oh, goodness. You know, goodness gracious. Thousands. You know, I mean, minimally, you're probably looking at $7,500 to $10,000. If your car is an older car and insurance is handling it, they're probably going to designate you getting a used engine. That can come with some of its own concerns. A newer car, like Jonah had described, if they didn't total it out, they probably would replace parts with new ones. But in all likelihood, that situation, the car is going to be called a total. You know, and the unfortunate part of that is that one of the other things that I learned back in 2018 when we had all that flooding is that, you know, in a given year in this country, there's 250,000 to 300,000 cars that are damaged by flooding, and many of them are totaled out by insurance companies and bought by salvage companies. Now, you know, some of those cars might have the good parts taken off and sold as used parts, but sometimes rebuilders will rebuild that car and put it back out on the road, and that is something I would never want to own personally. I mean, you know, the danger of mold building up in that car again somewhere, or of corrosion being in some electrical connectors and being a haunting continual problem down the road are pretty great, and you know, there are, at least back at that time when I did my research, you know, there were over 200,000 cars a year that were taken from flood, salvaged, and sold back into the market as used cars. So that is a problem. It's a greater problem around the coastal areas in this country. But, you know, I mean, the flooding, it seems like the trends in our climate are such that we're going to see more of this and not less.
Yeah. And with the rain, it always seems like the vehicle windshield fogs up during, especially a warm rain.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, the defrost turns the air conditioning on. That's how defrost works, is it dehumidifies that air with the air conditioning. So that you definitely want to make sure that you're using that, you know, blow it hard to try to keep it so you've got visibility and can see, because it can fog up pretty quick, and it's easier to turn it on right away and stay ahead of it than it is to catch up once it gets real humid inside the car.
Yeah. Well, let's talk for a minute before we take some calls about winter prep. You know, won't be long, I guess. Well, maybe longer than, well, you never know. So
it's feeling like it's coming pretty darn quick, though, I'll tell you, the way the weather feels right now. You know, my bigger concerns with winter on a vehicle are the battery and the tires. You know, lights and wipers follow pretty quickly behind that. But, you know, Larry, I would rather have an old rear-wheel drive car with good tires than a all-wheel drive or a four-wheel drive vehicle with bad tires to be driving through snow. You know, the tire tread depth is so important when it comes to both driving on wet roads and keeping your traction and keeping the tires good gripping the road. But in winter especially, you need to have something better than 5/32 of an inch. In the summer, you're kind of driving under hairy conditions with wet roads. If you have somewhere between 3/32 and 5/32, but in the winter, if you don't have 5/32 of an inch, you're going to have pretty compromised traction when we have snowy conditions if you've got to drive out in that stuff. And if you live well in the country and have to drive snowy roads before they're plowed, you're probably a candidate for snow tires. You know, I wouldn't say that most people probably need snow tires, but if, you know, if your driving takes you before early enough that before the plows are out or in rural enough areas that the roads aren't plowed yet, you're a good candidate for snow tires. You know, tires really, I think a lot of times people don't realize the tires are what caused them to slide or to lose traction or have problems, you know, but because the cause and effect is not always so obvious as it is, say, for like with a battery and a starting problem. If the car doesn't start, it doesn't take much of an investigation to find, you know, when a battery has failed in the wintertime, and that's that, and you know, I got to have a battery. But a lot of times you might almost lose control and just think, wow, you know, just something weird happened, and not realize, no, it's your tires. You would never have been in that situation if you had better tread and better tires. So, you know, as important as it is, I don't think the cause and effect of what tires can prevent and what actually happens is clear to people as like a battery failure or when your wipers don't clear and you can't see out the windshield or when you have lights out or other people have lights out and you can't see them or they can't see you.
Rick in Mayville has something for us relating to water, I believe. Rick, go ahead.
Yes, I just want part of your conversation about the brakes and water on the brakes. And yeah. I know when you do hit water, on like if you hit it on one side, a big mud puddle or something, and it gets on your brakes, my brother actually crashed my mom and dad's car because he hit the big puddle, and then he slammed on the brakes because he didn't realize it was that deep. So it only got water on the brakes on the one side, and the other side grabbed, and that side didn't, so he spun out and smashed the car.
No.
Yeah, but again, I'm not so sure I agree with the cause and effect there because, again, water does have minimal effect. And more likelihood what happened is that side hit the water and hydroplane and went up, and he probably overreacted and braked and lost control. But no, I can't agree with that. The brakes are minimally affected. That is, you know, you'd have to have some kind of a malfunction in your brake system. You know, I do believe that hitting the water in a hydroplane caused a crash, but not likely from the brakes.
No.
Overbraking, overreaction certainly could do it, but yeah, I can't agree with that.
Let's go to Samantha in Whitehall next. Samantha, hi. What's on your mind?
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering, I used to live in Arcadia. Now I live in Whitehall since 2014, and I was wondering what insurances cover people. Like, they were flooded twice. I was in a flood zone twice for that. And, you know, my car was flooded. Now, I'm not in that area anymore. What they would do for people in flood zones, plus also, how do you know if a car or truck or SUV or van that you want to purchase from, let's say, Joe Blow's stock is not going in, like, in a flood zone, like what I just talked about?
Yeah, so we've got a couple of things. Will,
yeah, a few things to unpack there. Well, one of the things is that what I would always recommend doing is having a Carfax check on a car that you're thinking about buying. And if it shows that a car has been totaled and it's been salvaged and rebuilt and retitled, you want to find out why. And if it's been flooded, then I would just turn and walk away. I'm not even going to investigate any further. I don't want to know anymore. So that's one thing that you would do. Insurance does cover, you know, flood damage. But one of the problems with that, like what we ran into, is that when a car is in a flood situation, there are probably several cars, many, many cars in a flood situation. It rarely is going to be one car. If it's just one car, you may get fairly quick action. But what I recall happening, and what I'm sure for to us, and what happened in Milwaukee, is that the insurance companies become overwhelmed. They only have so many inspectors to get out and look at cars. And as I was mentioning, once a car gets flooded and it's got water in that interior, hours and minutes actually count. You need to get the carpet out. It needs to be dried. You got to get a chemical like Concorbion on all those surfaces to stop and prevent mold. Electrical connectors need to be taken apart, dried out, have dielectric grease put in them to try to prevent corrosion from forming there. And if you know, I recall having cars sitting for days before anybody from an insurance company would come and look, and anybody would authorize anything to be done at all. And many, many cars were total that may not have been. So part of the problem isn't whether insurance is going to cover it or not. It's going to be whether action can be taken quickly enough to prevent ongoing problems.
Yeah, that makes good sense. Jim Ward, our guest, retired vehicle services manager. We're talking about your vehicle today. If you have a question, I hope you'll join in. Maybe it's about a repair issue. Maybe it's about buying another car and you want to have a question relating to it. Whatever the question, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking vehicle maintenance today with Jim Ward. Great to have Jim back, and always a pleasure to have him on the show. Questions, give a call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. John emailed us, and this is the kind of the time of year when people sometimes leave Wisconsin for a while. And he's wondering, what's the best way to store a vehicle for 6 months?
Well, a little bit depends on what you have access to. But I would make sure that the tires are inflated 3 to 5 pounds over what the recommended tire pressure is if it's going to sit that long. Not excessively overflated, but just a little bit to keep them from flat spotting is bad. If the car is going to be stored somewhere where you have access to power, to electricity, to an outlet, then you want to put a smart battery charger on it, which is something that senses the battery's state of charge, charges it when necessary, shuts off when not necessary. You can't just put a standard battery charger on that charges all the time. It'll ruin that battery in short order. If the car is going to be stored outside in Wisconsin and it's in a very rural area, I would have a lot of concerns about rodents getting in it, and I would use several different methods of things that with odors that mice don't like to, lights and different things that to try to keep mice out of the car. But the main things really are the battery and the tires, keeping the battery in a good state of charge or removing it from the car. You could put it, somewhere where it wouldn't freeze and then put it back in when you get back. But the best scenario is if you have access to power, have a smart charger and have the battery sufficiently inflated. And then I would do an oil change just before I stored it to make sure that you get any condensation that might be condensation actually does form in the crankcase and with the oil. And when you get an oil change, that's drained out. But you don't want that just sitting in there over the month. So I'd get an oil change just before I had that done as well. And those are really the main things right there.
All right. Well, let's go to Kathleen in Stevens Point, who has a question. Kathleen, hi.
Yes, good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And last year, I believe your presenter was on, and he recommended a gasoline additive, which I found and I purchased and I used. I didn't write it down.
This
and
would have
he
been
recommended. Oh, I'm sorry. Could you say that again, please? And
yep,
I've got
it,
a picture.
It would have been Seafoam, S-E-A-F-O-A-M, Seafoam.
Seafoam. And how often you recommend using that in a full tank of gas, please?
You know, I personally only put it in my gas tank a couple times a year. It's a good cleaner.
Okay.
It's not necessary to do that all of the time. It doesn't hurt to put a little in the oil as well.
The
container Seafoam right on it, or you can also go to their website, will tell you how much you'd put in gas, how much you'd put in the oil. But it's something that will help clean deposits out of both the fuel system and out of the crankcase and the various surfaces that get lubricated by the oil and engine as well.
All right. Kathleen, there you go. Seafoam. Let's go to Sandra in Beloit. Hi.
Hi. Good morning. I have a 2009 Hyundai Sonata, and I'm having a problem where when you have the outside air coming in, I keep smelling exhaust, whether it's heat or air conditioning. And the only way I don't smell it is if I put on the recirculation thing. Mm. I don't know what to do with this.
Smelling exhaust when turning on the AC or the heat?
Now, you know, I don't want to presume that I know what that smells like, because I could just guess that yes, it is exhaust, but obviously there's a possibility it's not exhaust. So what does this smell like to you? Because car exhaust really doesn't have much odor.
This smells, sometimes it smells like gasoline. Sometimes it just smells like your lawnmower smells, you know, something like that. But nobody seems to know what the problem is.
And have you headed to a shop to have them take a look and check for any kind of leakage, and they can't find a thing? You know, this is interesting. My son has a Toyota Camry, and he reports a very similar thing. And I've looked at that car, and I cannot find a fuel leak. I can't find an exhaust leak. I'm not sure, you know, and obviously without looking at it, I can't tell what you're smelling. You know, I don't know how the shop that has looked at it looked for an exhaust leak. One of the things that we do in a shop is that we will run the engine and kind of plug up the exhaust with a couple of rags and have a guy hold it. That pressurizes the rest of the exhaust. When you start it up an engine cold, the exhaust system is cold, and it may have a leak somewhere that after it warms up a little bit stops leaking. So it could be that you do have a leak during the warm-up cycle of the car somewhere in the front of the exhaust system that you could be smelling, and that by the time you drive it to a shop, it may be warm enough that the minute leak the things expand, and it may not leak anymore at that point. So that's a scenario I've seen before. You know, if you have this checked again, I would recommend taking it to the shop the night before and having them check it in the morning first thing before the exhaust has a chance to warm up and potentially seal something like that up. You know, other systems in the car, any kind of antifreeze leak, under the hood could be real minimal, but it can produce an odor, although most people describe antifreeze leaking is smelling kind of like a pancake syrup. I mean, it's kind of a sweet sort of smell.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that's what you're smelling. Again, exhaust in and of itself typically doesn't have a whole lot of odor once the car is warmed up. When it's cold, it might smell a little bit like fuel. And obviously raw gas leaks and raw gas smell like gas. Everybody kind of knows what that smells like. But, you know, I would encourage you maybe to have it checked for an exhaust leak again, but have them check it cold.
All right. Sandra, good luck. Thank you for calling. Let's go to Pamela in Wausau. Hi, Pamela.
Hi there. I am wondering, when you were talking about checking tire treads, how someone like me who doesn't know anything about cars can do that. I remember hearing about, like, putting a penny in and seeing what the thickness is, or is there something I can buy to measure it?
Well, they say that, you know, with a penny, the idea was that you put the penny in with Lincoln's head first, and if the space between the edge of the penny, if you could see the top of Lincoln's head, your tire tread is too thin. Now anymore, and we used to talk about 2 to 3/32 of an inch. Now for safe tread in winter driving, we talk about more like 5/32 of an inch. So the quarter is the new penny for that. We'd use a quarter for that. There is a little tool. They're cheap. You could buy it about any auto parts store that basically is a tire tread depth gauge, and it's just got a little metal pin that you put down in the tread depth and a little flat shoulder that rests on the top of the tread, and then you read a measurement. It tells you exactly how many 32nds of an inch. The other easiest way is that if you turn your tire, front tires out so that you can see them, or if you get close enough to the tire, in the tread of the tire, on every tire, about every foot or so, every few inches, there is a little bar in the bottom of that tread, and that's a tread depth indicator as well. And that little bar is 3/32 of an inch. So those little bars, you don't want to see your tread even with that. The tread should be deeper or thicker than that little bar. So there's several different ways you can do it, but almost any shop that you would go to, any tire shop, would be happy to measure your tires for free, and they'd probably do it right in front of you and show you the little tire tread depth gauge so you can be sure that you're seeing what the reading is yourself.
All right, Pamela, there you go. Thank you for calling. And let's turn to Pat in Madison. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I bought tires in November, and I'm wondering how long can I expect them to last, and can I really trust that tire symbol on my dash?
Well, that's a great question. And those two things are directly related, how long they're going to last and that tire thing on your dash. A tire pressure warning light on a dash is typically going to go off when the tire is 7 pounds below the tire, the car manufacturer's pressure. So a lot of cars, for awful lot of passenger cars, that not every car, you need to look at your own driver's door placard to see what it says for your car. But for most cars, it's going to be about 35 pounds. But with that threshold for the tire pressure monitor, that means that you may be running around with as little as 28 pounds of air in your tire. That's not going to cause your tire to go flat, but it is going to cause your tires to wear out prematurely. And the biggest reason people end up often getting about half of the life out of a tire that they could otherwise have gotten is that they're running around at that minimal amount of tread, air pressure, 28 pounds or so before the light comes on, and that causes the outside shoulders of the tire to wear, and it really doesn't matter which part of the tire wears most. Once the thinnest part of the tire is worn, the whole tire is worn out. It doesn't matter if the middle of the tire still has a lot of tread left. So, one of the most important things you can learn to do is to check your tires. Get a good tire pressure gauge or find a place that will do it for you. A lot of places, again, are happy to do those kind of things as a courtesy service. But, if you check your tires about once a month and keep that tire pressure up to the 35 rather than down closer to that 28, you're going to get a lot longer life out of your tires.
All right, Pat, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in, too, by the way. If you have a question, we'll get you on pretty quickly. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Let's go to Rich in La Crescent, Minnesota. Rich, hi.
Yes. Again, with the storing the car for 6 months over the winter, I did not hear you mention anything about a gas stabilizer. Is that something to do?
It is a good idea. And, it's like when the woman called about the seafoam, I almost threw it back in there, but the pace here is such I didn't quite get it. it's not a bad idea. Gasoline does turn into gummy, kind of a gummy mess over a period of time, and that seafoam. And seafoam is not the only product out there. It's just what I've used over the years and found to be one of the better ones. But that is certainly an important aspect too. Modern gasoline often we have a lot fewer problems with that than we used to, but it still happens, and the longer the car sits, the greater a chance of that happening. So something like seafoam in the gas when you store that car is going to help prevent that fuel from gumming up and causing valves in the fuel system to start to be problematic with sticking and stuff.
There you go, Rich. Thank you very much for calling. Kathleen emailed us. Her question is regarding the loss of oil on a 2016 Kia Soul. There are YouTube videos about this car and owner complaints on Consumer Reports. The car requires vast amounts of oil to be added between oil changes. There are no found leaks and no evidence of loss on the garage floor or under the hood. There's no appearance of burning oil when driving. They're constantly having to top up the oil by a quarter more every couple of weeks. This model is not part of a recall. The dealership says it's normal for this engine to use up the oil, but Kathleen says their experience seems anything but normal. Oil change shops agree and can't figure it out. The oil just does not seem to last. What to do?
Well, it is not normal. It is a known problem on that engine, and I don't think it was a recall that they did on those. I do believe that he had a customer support program if your vehicle wasn't too old or had too many miles on it. But they had problems with piston rings, and the piston rings would let oil run past and be burned. It's a problem with different cars. It sounds like they've already checked with a Kia dealership to make sure that there's not some kind of a program covering it from the description here, and it's unfortunate. I mean, it's not that the engine can't be fixed. They can tear the engine down and overhaul it and put new rings in. It's something that would cost several thousand dollars on a 2016 Kia Soul. I'm not sure, that it would be worth doing that, but that's a known problem with that engine, and they're not the only ones. So it's had a few different years and models. It's unfortunate when a manufacturer has something like that. They often come out with some kind of a customer support program and extension, but those can run out. They're not like safety recalls that last forever. So, you know, that's another thing that I would, you know, if you're looking at buying a used car of any kind, I would, you know, contact a dealer about recalls and customer support programs and do some investigating. Although that's one where if you look at a used car that's got that kind of an oil consumption problem, the exhaust systems, the catalytic converters that help clean up the exhaust, clean it up so well that you're not likely to see smoking, blue smoke and stuff like we used to see back in the day on a car that burned oil. There may not be any obvious symptoms short of driving it 500 to 1,000 miles and finding that out. So that's a very unfortunate fact of those engines, is that there may be no outside obvious visual sign that it has that problem. So that it can be very frustrating and very expensive to fix.
No. Well, Amy in Waupun has a different kind of question. Let's go there. Hi, Amy.
Hi. Enjoying your show. I have a 2021 Chevy Equinox, and it has plastic hubcaps, and they rattle, and I lost one of them. Who knows where? Is there anything I can do to secure them better, or is there a better kind of hubcap to get for?
You know, I'm not familiar with a particular aftermarket brand that would sound better. I'm sure there are plenty of different ones out there. I would recommend checking with the dealer, because that's a very new vehicle, fairly new vehicle yet, and it's, you know, the rattling you're describing would be really annoying to me, and I'm sure it's annoying to you, and I'm sure it's annoying to everybody else that's got one that does that. It would be very unlikely that they haven't come out with something, some kind of adjustment or something to address that. It's probably not a recall. It wouldn't rise to that level of concern, but there may very well be a technical service bulletin. I'm not familiar with one in particular, because any given model in a year has hundreds of bulletins that come out for little things like that. But that's the first thing I would do, is check with the dealer, see if this is a known issue, that there's some kind of a service bulletin to do. They might have an updated part, or they may have some adjustment on clips or rings that secure and tension that hubcap in place. But that does sound annoying.
It does indeed, Amy. Good luck. Thank you. Chris in Oshkosh, your turn. Hi, Chris.
Yeah, good morning, guys. Hey, you were talking about winter storage of vehicles. My wife and I recently went to replace a 10-year-old vehicle, and we have two homes, Wisconsin and Florida. We have a truck that goes back and forth and another car that is left in each location. Our intention was to replace the car that we keep in Wisconsin. I selected a Honda CR-V hybrid as being a very intriguing opportunity. And I pointedly asked the dealership the question, you know, can I store this thing over the winter? And their response was, oh, sure, hook it up to a battery charger, blah, blah, blah. Made a down payment, arranged to take delivery of the vehicle 2 days later, went home, and unlike, I think, a lot of people, I downloaded the owner's manual and started reading. Well, apparently, that is not a good idea at all. The manual clearly states you got to drive the vehicle every 2 months for at least 30 minutes, or you will destroy the drivetrain battery pack. About a $12,000 part. Don't know what the labor might be to install that, but I suspect strongly that the warranty claim would not have been honored when I came back in the spring. Had some heated words with the dealership. We did end up concluding a deal on a gas-powered version, but, of course, the gas mileage is hideous by comparison. Anybody in a certain or in a similar circumstance might want to take heed.
Yeah, and, you know, I've had... When I was still working before I retired, I had a few customers who would go to Florida every year and keep their Priuses, their Toyota Priuses with the hybrid battery setup in Wisconsin and store it like that. And Toyota had a similar warning about driving those cars. But I'll tell you, I never did see a problem with one. Now, as a consumer, if I read that, I would probably choose something else myself in that circumstance. But you know, that the manufacturer's warning in that instance never proved to be a problem with the Priuses, that because I would, every spring when they would come back, I would go over and reconnect. In some cases, they disconnected a 12-volt battery. In other cases, they had a battery charger up, but help them get the car going again. And ultimately, never did have a problem with the hybrid battery because of it. But Yeah, that it is a recommendation that they be driven more frequently. So, you know, you are quite unusual to have read an owner's manual, Chris. I props to you for doing that. And man, I tell you, if you're thinking of doing anything unusual with a vehicle, whether it's storing it or anything else, that one of the best things you can do to protect your investment is read the manuals and find out, you know, what the concerns may be with whatever you're planning to do.
Yeah, Chris, thank you very much for calling. Let's go to Alan in Preston, Minnesota next. Hi, Alan.
Hey, good afternoon. Good morning, guys. Great show as always. I have a question on spark plugs, but a quick setup on it. I took my 2017 Subaru Forester to the dealer for a transmission issue, surging at low speed and medium speed, whether the car is warm or cold. Within 2 hours, I got a call from the dealership telling me that I have the wrong spark plugs in, that I have Autolite brand spark plugs versus NGK. And they claim that Subaru can only run on NGK. And I'm thinking, as long as it's the right size and type of spark plug, does the brand name really matter? Could you speak to that, please?
You know, there are certain years and miles of vehicles that have picky ignition systems. I remember a couple of years of Toyota that they did not come with NGK from the factory, but people would put NGK in them, and they wouldn't run right, and we got to where we called NGK the no-good kind, whereas that really wasn't true across the whole market. They worked fine in most engines. You know, and for the most part, in my experience over most of my career, you're exactly right, that if it's a right rated spark plug, it didn't really matter what brand it was, but I have seen, you know, a couple of examples of certain vehicles. I'm not an expert on a 17 Forester having to have NGKs, and I just find it hard to believe that those would be the only ones that would work in there. But you know, it's more, you know, I think about certain spark plugs that wouldn't work with certain years, and it's a very uncommon, not at all a common situation. But I have seen it before. I have seen it, and it's funny to me that at the time that I experienced it, the NGKs were the ones that didn't work, and in this case, they're supposedly ones that do. But you know, there are, in the industry, sometimes there are incompatibilities, but that usually, particularly when it comes to maintenance items like spark plugs and filters and tires, that is typically very, very uncommon. But it does happen from time to time.
Oh, there you go, Alan. You were the lucky one. It happened to you. Oh, man. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Larry Mueller here with Jim Ward, retired vehicle services manager from Toyota of Madison. Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here talking vehicle maintenance with Jim Ward. And you can join in. We have some open lines. Get you on fairly quickly at 800-642-1234. Or if you'd like, email to talk@WPR.org. Allison in La Crosse has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Allison.
Hi, good morning. I have a question regarding my Mitsubishi Outlander 2018. I sometimes go to start the vehicle and it doesn't turn over. Sometimes it ticks. Sometimes it sort of runs like woo, 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 and then doesn't turn on at all. And then sometimes I go to my vehicle and it turns on perfectly. I've replaced the battery as well, and so that is new. And so I'm kind of up in arms as to what could possibly be the problem.
Well, it's interesting, the onomatopoeia you gave us, or woo-woo-woo, usually if an engine is turning over, which means you turn in the key and it's going rah, 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 like that, it's an indication that there is power to the starter and that the starter's running and that something else is wrong. It's not getting fuel or spark. Turning the key and just hearing a click implies not enough power is getting to the starter or something wrong with the starter that it's not turning the engine over. So, I mean, it almost sounds like there's potentially more than one thing going on here. I am wondering if we don't, you know, which makes me think we probably have an electrical connection problem somewhere. If the battery's replaced, they obviously put the cables to go on the battery on and tighten them down properly, but there is probably a loose ground or a connection somewhere else that's causing this kind of a problem where you're getting some power to the starter, and sometimes it's enough to turn it over, but not enough to start the engine, and sometimes it's not enough to even turn the starter over, because those two things, turning over sometimes and not starting and not turning over other times, kind of eliminates something wrong with the engine itself. I think you have, anyway, you know, from my experience, what I've seen, I think an electroconnection problem is probably what's at fault here.
All right. Take that back to your mechanic. And
the problem is these things are usually intermittent. Yeah. So it, you know, they may very well, you know, it's because you said sometimes it starts normally. So a shop may very well test it and not get any symptom and not, you know, and have it start fine. So it can very well be the kind of thing where, as hard as it is to do without a vehicle, you might have to leave it somewhere for a few days for them to be able to experience it, because they could easily jump in there and have it start just fine and not experience it and say, well, everything's great. That just means it's intermittent. Everything's not great, but it can take more time to fix it. So that's, you know, what I'd recommend is being able to leave it somewhere enough days that, from whatever your experience is, that you know if you only experience it once every 2 or 3 days sometimes, try to leave it somewhere 3 days or plan to leave it there that long so they have a chance to actually experience it.
Allison, good luck. Thank you. Rick in Appleton, we'll go to you now. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Larry. I just had a comment on the lady that had issues with what she thought was like a gas leak in her vehicle or something of that nature.
Yeah.
I helped my sister with a older Saturn View, and she had a similar circumstance where it turned out to be a very small oil leak around her valve cover gaskets. It's hard to spot, but I went through with the wrench and just checked all the bolts for the valve covers, and lo and behold, some of them were extremely loose, and that minute amount of oil going down on the exhaust manifolds was causing that odor. So I just wanted to pass that along.
All right.
Sure. And when it, you know, even if you don't smell the odor, when you look at the car, you could see that sign of oil leakage. You could see where it was on the exhaust. So that's certainly a prime thing to even if they're not experiencing the odor, have looked the exhaust over from front to rear, because where the oil is dripping on it, you're going to be able to see that. You're going to be able to see that stained spot. So,
thanks, Rick. Appreciate it very much. Jordan in Eau Claire emailed us. They've been looking at buying a Ford Lightning, and have seen so many for sale that Carfax says has a lemon title on it. Some online research says it was mainly from parts shortages. Any insights that you know of, or any parts more readily available?
You know, I really don't have much direct experience with that vehicle. I saw it was a very interesting format when it came out. Interesting truck. I personally just haven't had any experience with them to know if a part shortage has caused something. But it, you know, Lightning is a new enough vehicle that I would be hoping that you wouldn't have to have a lot of replacement parts for them yet. So I would have to do some more investigating on that. I just couldn't say.
Let's go to Brad in Janesville. Brad, hello.
Hello. I have a 2016 Toyota Prius, and I had to replace the latch for the fuel door filler. That latch actually shuts off the ability to add gasoline to the tank, so it became a critical emergency. Cost me $1,000, actually just under $1,000, to get that part replaced, parts and labor.
Ooh.
That seems extremely high. I recall seeing that problem on Priuses, which, it's not as simple as just pop the door open and still be able to add gas. Man, I can't. I think a lot of expense. I can't imagine why it would have been that expensive. I don't recall off the top of my head that the part. I don't remember being over a couple $100s, and the labor not being much more than an hour and a half, and even at $150 an hour. I can't understand why that would have been expensive. It's a repair I've heard of, but boy, that is just a lot of money to pay for that.
Yeah, it sure sounds like it. Mike in Poinette, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi. My question is about an ABS system in my 2014 Toyota Tacoma. My traction light and my ABS light have come on. I had it looked at a parts store, and they said it was the wheel speed sensor front left. I'm wondering, I had a 99 Chevy Yukon, and my ABS light came on with that. And a mechanic told me to just pull a fuse on it, and you'd have regular brakes, which is what I grew up with as a kid. And I'm wondering, is this wheel speed sensor critical to operating car, or is it just something where I can pull a fuse and ignore the, then I won't have to see the lights?
Well, you don't likely have to pull a fuse, because if the light's on, the system has already likely disabled the traction control and anti-lock brakes. You could go on a gravel road somewhere and try, you know, carefully hitting your brakes real hard and see if the anti-lock brakes engage. I'm betting they will not. When the warning light's on, the computer disables them anyway. So you, in the time that that light has been on, you have been just driving with conventional brakes and without traction control anyway. So that's kind of how it works on the Toyota. You don't really have to pull a fuse. The computer's already done that. But that typically isn't a hugely expensive repair. So, something you might want to save up for, because anti-lock brakes are a handy thing to have in the winter.
Yeah, they are indeed.
Or traction control, for that matter.
Mike, there you go. Thanks for calling. And let's go to Kathleen in Marshall, Wisconsin. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, this is Kathleen. We have a 2019 Tacoma. It has about 120,000 miles on it. We just bought it a couple of months ago. And just lately, when you want to start it, the key won't turn. So in other words, the steering wheel is locked and you can't turn it. So it's really scary, because plus when you're stranded up somewhere, and I'm in the vehicle right now, and I have to go to the store, so I'm almost afraid to turn it off. And then our mechanics are going to try to keep the steering wheel straight, keep your hands off the steering wheel. And what else do you suggest? I mean, any suggestions?
Well, this is what you're describing is something that could happen to any vehicle with the steering lock, but usually only if the wheels are like turned all the way extreme to one way or another. Some people do that every time they park too. It's like up against a curb or something, turn the wheel all the way to right or to the left. If you do that, you are more likely to have the steering lock lock in such a way that it seems like the key won't turn. And what usually you'll find is that it'll be against some spring pressure, but you'll find that you can turn the steering wheel an inch or so to the left or the right against some spring pressure, and in the middle of that range that the steering wheel will turn, the key should turn. It's possible that's called an interlock system, that system between the steering wheel and the ignition. And it's possible something in that system could get out of adjustment and cause it to stick like you're describing. That's pretty uncommon, but it could happen. And, but at least in the short term, if you are, sitting in the vehicle right now and it were to be locked, that's the technique I would recommend, is turning the steering wheel, and right in the middle of that range the wheel will turn, the key should be able to turn and start it.
All right.
But if it's a continual problem and you're not turning the wheels, you're not parking it with the wheels turned all the way to an extreme, I would take it to a shop and have them check it out, because it doesn't sound quite normal.
All right. Kathleen, thank you very much. And Pete in Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Pete.
Hey, good morning. I have a 2019 Toyota Highlander, and I brought it to the dealer with a high-pitched whine. And he told me that it was the transmission, and it needed to be replaced. And they've been having quite a few issues with this 2019 Highlander. So by chance, I had I do have an extended warranty, so my warranty would cover it. And I said to him, so if I didn't have a warranty, would I be on the hook for the $8,000? He's like, yeah. And, they haven't recalled it. So, what that tells me is that there's problems with Toyota, and they're not willing to own up to it. You worked at the Toyota dealership.
I did. I recall that problem. Yeah, Toyota had a defect. They had some roller bearings that would fail in that transmission, and they did have a customer support program for it. So if you were at a Toyota dealer and they told you that, I would contact another dealer. Toyota's, most manufacturers have a warranty, and when the warranty's over, it's kind of over. But when there's a known problem like that, they often have customer support programs to extend coverage. As I recall, it seems like most of these were caught fairly early on. I mean, at the 2019, have you owned the vehicle since it was new?
Yes.
And how many miles were on it?
About 100.
About 100,000. And this noise just started up more recently.
Yeah, and it was a real high-pitched whine, and when I brought it in, the guy's like, yeah, we've had a problem. And
sure. Yeah, and that's true, although I'd have to say, in my experience, most of the time that transmission would fail before 10,000 miles and certainly be under factory warranty. But they did have a customer support program. So if you were at a Toyota dealer, I would either ask them to double-check with Toyota, go to bat for you, and ask them if they – well, of course, if you've got an extended warranty that's going to cover it, you're in good shape. But you know, just something doesn't seem quite right. That's not quite been my experience with Toyota. If you bought the vehicle new, you got 100,000 miles, and had that kind of a problem – I would expect, even if you didn't have, you know, extended warranty, that they would say, well, we'll cover parts or something along those lines. It's very uncommon that they would just leave you hanging like that, especially when it's a known problem. They had a program for it. Any manufacturer can have it. And you know, it wasn't most Highlanders. It was, in my experience, we sold a lot of cars. We had maybe six or a dozen that had that, of hundreds and hundreds of that model sold.
Well, there we go. And tell you what, Jim Ward is going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. We'll take a quick look at the news, and then you can join in with more questions for Jim. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Jim Ward, a vehicle maintenance expert. He's a retired vehicle services manager, worked in the industry for 36 years. Questions? Lots of callers online. We've got some emails, so we'll get right to it. Beth in Cottage Grove emailed us. Beth has a 2022 Honda Insight that will display speed as kilometers per hour. But when Beth switches display to miles per hour, it goes blank. What's more odd is using cruise control, it will display miles per hour when Beth is at the set speed, but disappears when the speed changes. Is this a known issue?
I'm not familiar with it, but I am going to bet that it is with Honda. I would definitely contact a dealer and run that by them. Yeah, there's something in the module there, and that's the kind of thing that can often just be a software update, the way those modules work. So I'm not familiar with that as a known problem on it, but it's an odd one. And again, I would be surprised if there wasn't a software update or something to resolve that.
Okay, Sydney in Alabama, your turn. Hi, Sydney.
Hi. I have a 2014 Volkswagen Passat, and when I'm, like, speeding up or slowing down, my car's, like, kicking, almost like it doesn't want to shift down or, you know, kick into gear. I was wondering if you knew what that might be.
And it's an automatic transmission?
Yes.
Yep. If an engine problem can cause surging, or a transmission can cause surging. Have you had anything done? Have you inspected it by anyone to try to get some insight as to what's going on at all yet?
No, I am going to bring it in today.
What I recommend is taking someone for a ride. Show them what you're talking about. I've seen this kind of thing often with modern with electronically controlled transmission, which this has, are often a little too sensitive, and they can be what some people describe as twitchy. And a lot of manufacturers have had software updates for that problem, too, to kind of change the characteristics of how the transmission behaves to try to resolve that kind of an issue. I would definitely take it in, have someone go for a ride, show them what you're talking about. But then I'd also follow up and just check with a Volkswagen dealer and find out if there's not a service bulletin about a software update for that problem as well.
All right. Sydney, there you go. Thank you for calling. Meg in Richland Center, your turn. Hi, Meg.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing. What's on your mind?
So we got a new-to-us minivan, a Toyota Sienna, super low miles. It's lovely. It's perfect. But we realized that there's mice. And we believe it's kind of like in the front dash or like underneath the center console area. And they're just so pesky. We cannot get rid of them. We're trying not to use poison because we have young kids and an outdoor cat. So any tips for getting rid of that?
Well, you know, there's a lot of different products that they say, have odors that mice don't like. you know, I find that, with trying to keep mice out of anything, that variability is what's important. They get used to anything. You know, yeah, there might be, you know, the dryer sheet might deter them for a little bit, but there's something in there. You know, number one, don't keep any food or snacks or anything there. Unfortunately, there's some aspects of vehicles, and there's something about the insulation that they use on wiring that mice and a lot of rodents see as food and smell as food. There may be some kind of vegetable base to some of the wiring. You know, and I understand the concern of not using poison. If you're not using poison, you may want to consider using some traps. You know, it's dealing with dead mice isn't fun, but dealing with damage that mice can cause in a vehicle is much less fun. So, you know, if you don't want to have to deal with actually seeing and handling the mouse, there are traps that are like a little black box that they go into and they dispatch the mouse and you don't have to see it. You just throw the whole thing away after it indicates that it's got one. But, you know, they can do a lot of damage. I have literally seen vehicles totaled out due to wiring damage caused by mice. So I wouldn't put this off, and I wouldn't, you know, trying different scents and different kind of things like that can take a long time to try to figure out what's right. And, you know, I wouldn't want to take that much time. So I would recommend getting some kind of a kill trap, something that you could live with, and just get them out of there, out of the vehicle. And then, you know, after that, you know, keeping them out, a mouse can get through any kind of an opening that you could stick a pen or a pencil through. They, you know, their skulls aren't hard like ours. They can kind of fold. So it doesn't take much of an opening for them to be able to get in, but there are various deterrents, again, that smell really bad, that can be used and put into, like, where the air intake is in different areas where they can access to help repel them. But if they've already taken up residence, you need to as quickly as possible eliminate them before they start doing some damage to your wiring.
Yeah. All right, Meg, good luck. Thank you. Becky in Madison, your turn. Hi, Becky. Becky, are you there? I guess we may have lost Becky. Let's go to Bob in Onalaska. Hi, Bob.
Yeah, good afternoon.
What's on your mind?
So we have a 2015 Kia Sorento. When we first started up, there's a rattle. It seems to be coming from, I'd say, driver's side, kind of by the back seat underneath. And if we drive it for a little bit, it goes away. And if we stop, let's say run into a store or something like that, when we start it back up, it's gone. It's got to sit for about 2 or 3 hours before it would happen again. I'm just curious what your opinion might be.
Can't say it's something I've run into. I mean, my initial thought is that there's something on the exhaust system that's rattling back there, a hanger or something that is either bent or too tight, been tweaked or something. You know, this kind of thing comes down to somebody starting the vehicle. Well, somebody else is underneath it. You know, preferably you've got to shop it under a lift, but even on the ground, you know, someone may be able to lay beside it and hear this and be able to tell where it is. When you first start the car cold and it's doing it, the exhaust isn't going to be hot yet. So one of the things you could try is go to the back of the car with a rag, put it on the tailpipe and move the tailpipe left, right, up and down and see if that tension that you're doing when you do that changes, stops, affects the noise at all. It could be something entirely different, but that, you know, a heat shield on the exhaust or something related to the exhaust system is usually the cause of the kind of thing you're describing. And the exhaust heats up, things expand as they heat up, and that often can be why the noise stops once the vehicle is warmed up.
Bob, good luck with it. Thank you for calling. Pam in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Pam.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Okay, about 3 weeks ago, I bought a 2017 Subaru Outback from a small dealer. And he showed me a Carfax, but I didn't have time to look at it. I thought he would give it to me, but he didn't. And when I got home, I noticed that there was no owner's manual. And some of the, I've been having problems opening the windows, especially on the passenger side. So I'm wondering if, I'm wondering if I should take it back. Or, you know, if
when did you buy it?
About three weeks ago.
I would definitely contact him, take it back. I mean, at the short time you owned it, I would think they would probably help you out. I mean, typically used cars in Wisconsin are sold as is, meaning whatever it is, it is. It's not a new car. But most dealers are concerned, want their customers to be happy, so you know, they'd probably be willing to take a look at it. While you're there, I would ask them to print out that Carfax and take a copy of it. If they showed it to you, they'd be able to pull it up again. I mean, a dealer pays a subscription for Carfax. So it doesn't matter how many cars they look up or how many times they print that out, so they should be perfectly willing to give that to you. Owner's manuals are also something that there's no legal requirement they give to you. When you say that you're having problems, do you mean that the window doesn't work at all, or it goes slow, or it goes partially up or down, or what does the window actually do?
It doesn't open at all.
Doesn't open at all.
And okay. just one given window doesn't operate. Is that right?
Right.
Yeah, so, yep, I would take it back and have them check that out, take a look, and you know, hopefully they'll be able to work with you and help you out with getting to the bottom of that and getting it fixed.
Yeah, good luck, Pam. Thank you. Brian in Ironwood, Michigan, your turn. Hi, Brian.
Hi. Hello, afternoon. Hi. I just picked up a 2020 Toyota RAV4 with 85,000 miles on it, and I'm wondering what you recommend for oil after doing some research, because it takes 0-16 or 0-W-16. And I'm seeing that Toyota has a lot of Moly in it. So would you recommend like Toyota, or do you recommend Mobil 1?
Well, the brand doesn't matter, right? You know, whether you use Toyota oil. In fact, I think Mobil might be the company that supplied Toyota with their oil. But what's important is that it's a zero, the OW16 is what you want to make sure the weight of the oil is. You know, the engine, the fuel mileage it gets, the friction that it's designed to deal with is based on that right oil rating. The brand is insignificant. It's more important that you get 0W16.
All right, Brian, good luck. Thank you. Gary in Sister Bay, your turn. Hi, Gary.
Hi, I got a 2013 VW Passat, and I love it, but it's got a low beam headlight issue. The headlight was out. I replaced the bulb. The old bulb had the melted filament in it, but the headlight still doesn't work. I looked up, and there was a recall on this in 2014. The headlight bucket is the whole replacement is the only real option for me. Otherwise, what are my chances getting a recall at this point?
Well, I don't know if that was deemed a safety recall. Safety recalls are forever. It doesn't matter whether you're the original owner, 10th owner, 100th owner, and there's no time limit on them. Far more common are customer support programs where they'll say, well, we know we've got a problem with this. It doesn't rise the level of safety recall. Therefore, we're going to cover it for X period of time. A Volkswagen dealer would be able to tell you what the parameters of that coverage are. So I would definitely check them with Volkswagen. Have your VIN number ready, the vehicle identification number. If you're going to call them on the phone, you give them that number. They can run it on their computer and tell you what program it has and whether you still have coverage.
All right. There you go, Gary. Good luck. Thank you. Beth in Madison, your turn. Hi, Beth.
Hi, how are you?
Good, appreciate your call. What can we do for you?
Well, I have a 2021 Honda CR-V, and not every time, but often when it's humid or it's been raining, when I'm backing up, it's only when I'm backing up, the brakes sound like a foghorn. And I did take it to the dealer, and they couldn't figure it out, and then they tried to replace a part, but it still does it. And I'm just wondering if there's any thoughts on what that could be.
You know, what it is most likely related to the compound of the brake pads. I've seen this before on certain models. It's not likely hurting anything, but it can be really annoying, and, you know, if you're having to back out of your driveway earlier in the morning, you know, your neighbors, the rest of your family really don't want to hear that loud sound. It can be really annoying. You know, it sounds like there's different Toyota models have had that problem and had updated brake pads, and sometimes they had to go through a couple different compounds before they found just the right one. Sometimes, though, this is also related to oxidation buildup on the brake rotor, the part that the pad rubs against. And, you know, one thing that sometimes just a modification of driving. It's a good idea to brake early, to brake lightly, you know, and to not be hard on your brakes. It makes them last longer. It makes smoother driving. But sometimes some friction on the brakes help. That friction helps grind the oxidation off that forms on brake rotors, on the parts that the brake pad rubs against. And that oxidation is what helps create that noise. It's what's called a slip stick, as the pad sticks and then slips. When it's got oxidation, it's grinding it off. So taking the car out on the highway and being careful there's nobody behind you, and being careful that you don't hit the brakes so hard you lock them up, but giving them, heating them up good a couple of times, hitting them pretty hard a couple of times. If you do that and then you find that after that you don't have that noise for a couple of weeks, it is just oxidation buildup, and there may not be much else that could be done about it. You could probably get some aftermarket ceramic pads or something that might create more friction and help resolve it. But that's the nature of that kind of a problem. It's not like something that's going to keep your brakes from working. The noise can be awfully annoying, though, that's an experiment you can do for yourself. Just take it out, brake harder a couple of times, and see if that doesn't resolve it for a week or two.
Yeah. All right, Beth, thank you for calling. And Tracy in Blanchardville, what's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. So I've got a 4Runner 2008 that I've heard that from my mechanic that the frame is very rusty and I shouldn't put a lot of money in. It's got 199,000 miles on it, but I still like it and it still runs fine. I've also heard that some Tacomas and 4Runners were, maybe it wasn't a recall, but there's a lawsuit or a class action suit on the frames themselves because they rusted early. I wondered if your guest could comment on that, if there's any hope for me. I'd love to have a new frame on my 4Runner.
Sure. Yeah, there are a number of different Tacoma and Tundra models that had frame rust through problems. It was something that was seen very occasionally on 4Runners, not very often, but very occasionally we'd see a 4Runner that had that problem. On an 08 vehicle, I don't know what the chances are. That it's a very expensive repair, and when Toyota did do those repairs on some of the Tacomas, it was a $14,000-$15,000 warranty claim many years ago, and this was something that was being done at that time on like 01 through 04 vehicles. But I would certainly follow in the class action suit. You know, it might be possibly just some money back. It's certainly not going to be something that's practical for an individual to pay for and replace the frame. And although there are companies that make repair kits, a repaired frame is not the safest thing, not the best thing. Someone really has to know what they're doing and where to cut it, where to piece in something else to try to repair something like that. So repair is really not a very practical thing. If Toyota were to stand up and say they'd replace frames, you know, in many cases they didn't even do that. They just they basically bought the vehicle back from people, and the buybacks actually were probably fairly generous back then at that time. So I would follow the information on the class action suit. I don't think repair is going to be a practical endeavor for this vehicle.
Tracy, thank you for calling. Bob in Iron River, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question. We have a 2023 Lincoln Navigator. We just purchased it two and a half weeks ago from a Ford dealer, and it has 75,000 miles on it, and the battery was replaced in June. If you let the vehicle sit for 2 to 3 days, the battery goes dead. I jump-started it. I did my due diligence. The alternator is charging at 14 volts. The battery's good. It starts and runs fine after you jump-start it. And if you run it every day, it's fine. We took it to the dealer. We bought an extended warranty, and they're telling us they can't fix it. It's an electrical issue. They thought it would have been the rear windshield wiper hanging up or something, but they can't fix it. What do you think our options are for this vehicle?
Well, I've heard of that problem on Lincoln Navigators before, so I don't think this is, I don't think yours is a one-of-a-kind thing there. But I believe that there's an electrical draw from some system on that vehicle. And basically, that can be tricky to find because an electrical draw means something's turning on or drawing more power than it should. And it's probably not something like a rear wiper because you'd see that in all likelihood if it were running. But, it basically, a skilled shop would have to go through a fairly long diagnostic procedure to track it down. You know, what I essentially have done in the past is to pull fuses, you know, find the draw on a given trunk in at the fuse box and pull fuses one at a time until I eliminate it. Then at least I have it narrowed down to maybe 10% of the vehicle's electrical wiring and systems. But, you know, somewhere I believe on that vehicle there's an electrical draw. I wish I could tell you. I don't know what or where it is, but there is. It can be diagnosed and it can be fixed, but they can be very frustrating, especially if it's an intermittent problem, and electrical problems often are. So, yeah. You know, they're throwing up their hands, but that doesn't mean it can't be fixed.
All right, Rob. Thank you for calling. Megan in Sauk City, your turn. Hi, Megan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a Toyota Avalon 2003, and it's been intermittently when I back up. Sometimes it sounds like a can scraping, and I'll get out and look. I don't see anything under the car scraping, but I feel like it's started happening more often now.
Have you been able to notice, is this just while you're on your brake, when you're braking, when you're backing up? Or if you let the brake off and back, does it still make the noise when you're not on the brake?
I feel like when I'm not on the brake.
When you're not on the brake is when you're hearing it. Well, it does sound like something like an exhaust problem. It's going to involve someone looking at it while it's doing it. You know, you can't obviously drive over someone, so hopefully it will do it when it's on a lift. You know, when someone has it on a hoist in a shop and puts it in reverse with somebody up inside the car, they can be underneath it and listen. You know, most often that kind of sound turns out to be from the exhaust system, like a heat shield or something that's gotten out of adjustment. But, it's going to be a matter of someone doing some experimentation, hearing it, and kind of playing around with some different things. Usually you can manipulate the exhaust from under the vehicle when you have it up on a lift, so if they can make it do it, they can often pretty quickly get down to the cause of it. It at least finding the cause is often not real expensive. So I would encourage you to take it somewhere where you can show them what you're hearing, and then they can try to duplicate it on a lift and see what they find.
All right. Good luck, Megan. Thank you very much for calling. Terror emailed us a few years back. Terror also had problems with mice in the dash, going back to an earlier call. It turns out they nested in the cabin filter, and Terror's wonderful husband cleaned this compartment out and added a hardware cloth wire barrier. No more problems after that.
It's a good idea if that's where they're getting in. And it is one of the entry points. I think you mentioned that they have some screening up where the air comes in up under your wipers. But, again, it's not real fine screening, and a mouse can get in and you can put a pencil through. So, that may be the source, and that's not a bad idea.
Bruce emailed, for checking tire pressure, is using valve stem extensions okay? The valve stem is too far back to get the inflation hose on it.
I've never seen a problem with valve core extensions. You know, I've seen various vehicles use them because of that access issue. You make sure that they're tight when you put them on. But, yeah, I've not seen problems with those.
Well, on that note, I think we are about out of time here, Jim. I want to thank you so much for being with us today, and I hope you'll come back and be with us again. Really appreciate your time.
You bet. You bet. Thanks, Larry.
Jim Ward, retired vehicle services manager at Toyota in Madison. Lots of years' experience, and it's always a pleasure to have him on the show. And we'll get him back, and we'll go over your problems next time around if you didn't get on today. Sorry we didn't get to everybody, but that's kind of the way it usually works. Coming up, we're going to take a look at Wisconsin's largest auto museum in Hartford, Wisconsin. That next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.
Beep, 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 his horn went beep, beep, beep. My car went into passing gear and we took off with gust. Soon we were doing 90, must have left him in the dust. When I peeked in the mirror of my car, I couldn't believe my eyes. The little Nash Rambler was right behind, I think that guy could fly. Beep, 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 beep.
The little Nash Rambler, a song popular I believe in 1958. It was sung by the Playmates. And the Little Nash Rambler, I believe, is one of the cars you're going to find at Wisconsin's largest auto museum. It features more than 120 vehicles and really dedicated to vehicles manufactured here in the state. Larry Mueller here, and great to have with us Dawn Bondas. She is the executive director of the museum, as I said, located in Hartford, Wisconsin. And as we talk with her, we want to hear from you. Tell us about maybe the classic car you own. What do you know about its history? Did you or other members of your family help make cars in Wisconsin? Love to hear about that as well. And the number to call is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Dawn Bondas, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Larry. Happy to be here.
So you've got some Nash Ramblers at the museum. Maybe just to start, maybe talk about the Wisconsin Automotive Museum and its history.
Yeah, well, we do have Nash Ramblers, but the museum started in 1986, so we're looking forward to our 40th anniversary next year. And it took a while to grow into what it is now. When it first opened up, there were 46 cars. They were all on loan. Currently, we have 126 vehicles on two floors, and we feature heavily on Wisconsin-built cars. So the Kissel, which was made in Hartford, but others like Nash and Rambler, we have a Mitchell, we have a Winther truck, American Motors, of course, came along a little bit later, and we have the only known Badger to exist. So the dates go from 1902 into the 1990s.
Oh, my gosh. What was the Badger like?
Well, the Badger was made over in Columbus, Wisconsin, and it only had two model years, 1910, 1911. And there were only a couple hundred cars made. So it was definitely one of those brass era cars.
Really interesting. And by the way, what do you do? How did you come to work there and be its executive director?
Well, I have always loved history, and I have always worked in museums. And maybe part of it is I've, you know, maybe loved my own personal vehicles a little too much. But I grew up on a farm in western Minnesota, and it probably didn't hurt that I learned to drive way too young.
Okay. And, you know, you think about it, Detroit is the first place that comes to mind when you hear about car making.
Mm-hmm.
But we've got some history in Wisconsin. And maybe start by talking about the Kissel Motor Car Company.
Right. Well, Kissel Motor Car Company, earliest part of the 20th century, it seems like everybody and their brother was into manufacturing cars. It was a huge bug that had, you know, just was really biting everyone across the nation. And there were a couple of the Kissel brothers, Will and George, were into this. Their family had a manufacturing background with Hartford Plow Works. But they wanted to manufacture cars, which they did, and they wanted to manufacture a higher-end car, not just a car for the masses, which is what Henry Ford wound up doing with his Model T. So they were in it for performance and for styling and endurance, just like some manufacturers today. But Kissel had a good run. They went from 1906 to 1931. It was the Depression that took them down, just like a lot of other car manufacturers. But Kissel was known for its styling and its durability. It was one of those cars of the stars. So Amelia Earhart, Greta Garbo, William Randolph Hearst, some pretty recognizable names of the time were driving Kissel. They were also known for making so much of the car in Hartford. So it wasn't, you know, they were doing the upholstery there. They were doing their own engines for a long period of time. And that was something they really took a lot of pride in.
That's pretty darn cool, actually, that it was manufactured in Hartford, right where your museum is located. I think it's off Highway 41, isn't it? It's kind of north and a little west of Milwaukee?
Yeah, Well, it's north a ways of Milwaukee, but if you're coming out that direction, yes, you would take Highway 41, and then Highway 60 is just, you know, about a block and a half south of the museum. If you drive through Hartford on Highway 60, you can see the museum.
So problems, the financial problems of the 30 were what brought it down, but there were, I'm trying to remember, it was something like they made something like 27,000 cars, did they not?
They did, and it sounds like a lot, but when you spread that out over the 25 years, it is a low production car. 1925 was their highest production year, and they were making a little over 2,000 cars that year. So demand went up and down. It varied from year to year.
And so you have, how many Kissel vehicles do you have?
Right now we have 30.
And
there's only around 150-ish complete Kissels left. So what we have is the most you will see in one place anywhere in the world.
Oh, my goodness. How did the museum get these cars?
Well, it's taken 39 years to get to this point. But we have, with all of the cars at the museum, it's about a 40-60 split, cars that are here on loan versus ones that have been donated to the museum. And the same is true of the Kissels. Some have been donated to the museum, and others are on loan here.
You've got a new Kissel, a new addition, I should say, to the Kissel exhibit.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Kissel fire truck.
Yes.
It's a ladder truck, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, and not only that, it was Hartford's. So it was used from 1920 when it was made until 1963, and it was sold into private ownership. And it has been out of state for decades. It was actually owned at a different museum in Arizona, in the Phoenix area, the Hall of Flame. And it's the Vintage Fire Company of Wisconsin recently acquired the truck, and it is now on loan here. So it's very exciting to have it back in Hartford. And we have a couple of other Kissel fire trucks on exhibit. One is from Juneau, but the other one is Hartford's 1923 truck. And that truck makes regular appearances in Hartford's Christmas parade in November.
So what does it look like, the new one?
The ladder truck?
Yeah.
Well, it's mainly, the ladders are very visible, and the ladders were actually taken from a horse-drawn piece of equipment. So it is very long. It's the longest wheelbase that we've got in the museum. And it's got hard rubber tires. And you could check out, you know, our Facebook or Instagram page, because we did posts about a month ago when the vehicle came in.
Yeah. Have you done any restoration on it, or what restoration has taken place?
No, we don't do restoration here. We don't have a facility or staff for that, and it's also not owned by the museum. But it does need new rear rubber tires on it before it can really go out and do anything, and the owner is looking into that, and also he wants to check out some of the mechanical issues to see, you know, how it does run, but is it going to cooperate doing a greater distance than just off the truck and into the museum.
So who actually owns the truck then?
It is the Vintage Fire Company of Wisconsin.
The Vintage Fire Company of Wisconsin.
They're a nonprofit organization.
Oh, man. Any particular stories or memories associated with the truck?
Oh, with the truck? There are some awesome photos of it. There's a photo that was taken in Hartford at the Chandelier Ballroom, and that's what it is known as now. Previously, it was known as the Schwartz Ballroom. The photo was taken in 1936, and it shows Hartford's three Kissel fire trucks lined up there. They had a 1912 chemical truck. They had their 1923 truck that I mentioned, and the ladder truck. So, you know, it's just so cool to see those photos from, you know, decades ago and then see the actual truck here.
The Wisconsin Automotive Museum has several other, obviously, Wisconsin-built cars. Tell us about a few of the other cars you have and the specialty vehicles you might have on display.
Sure. Well, some of the Wisconsin ones I mentioned, Winther truck. Winther was around and manufactured for about 10 years, and we also have a 1902 Rambler, which is the first car, or the oldest car that's in the museum, and Rambler, the Jeffrey Company, made the Rambler. That is the company that Charles Nash purchased when he was going to manufacture cars under his own name. So then we have a number of Nashes. Nash and Hudson merged. Hudson was made in Wisconsin the last 3 years of its production, so 1955 to 57. But when Nash and Hudson merged, that's what made American Motors. So the whole geeky car genealogy thing. So then we do have some American Motors, including a Rambler, and I love that song that you played. That was fabulous. And we have QR codes on some of our signboards, and with the 1961 Rambler that's upstairs, you hit the QR code, and it takes you to that song.
And you've had a relationship, or the museum has had a relationship with the Nash Car Club, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, the Nash Car Club of America for over 30 years has had dedicated space within the museum. So they exhibit not only cars, but other Nash-related items. So it could be, you know, it's the hood ornaments, it's tools, it's other memorabilia. But, yeah, so they've got dedicated space on the first floor of the museum.
Dawn Bondas, our guest today, who is executive director of the Wisconsin Automotive Museum in Hartford. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments as we move along. Do you have a family member, or maybe you yourself, work in manufacturing a car, maybe a part of a car here in Wisconsin or elsewhere? Give a call. The number, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mailer for WPR News. Tomorrow on Garden Talk, Neil DeBole returns, and he's going to be talking with us about native prairie plants. And as well, we'll help you identify invasive plants that you might find in your garden but don't want there. That's tomorrow on Garden Talk. Right now, we're visiting with Dawn Bondas, executive director of the Wisconsin Automotive Museum in Hartford, Wisconsin. And again, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. We've talked about the Nash and a bit about the Kissels and also the Badger. Kissel, not only made cars, obviously, the fire trucks. Did they make other trucks as well?
They did. They made a wide variety of weights of trucks, so anything from down from a half ton to, you know, a multi-ton truck, and then in many cases, whoever was ordering it would have the body outfitted the way they wanted to. So it might have been a grocer's truck. Police departments would use them. Other types of delivery trucks, stake bed trucks. We do have a few of just general, a couple of Kissel trucks at the museum. And then towards the end of their run, Kissel made taxi cabs, Bradfield Taxi. That was later in the 1920s and early 30s that they were doing that. And then they were making a combination hearse ambulance. So they were, you know, in the professional vehicle market as well.
Very interesting. The one that interested me a lot, I think the nickname was the Gold Bug, and that was that two-passenger speedster.
Right.
That what did that kind of look like?
Well, the Speedster was, that's Kissel's most famous model. And when I was talking about the well-known Kissel owners, that's typically the model that they had. But it was, it's the earliest ones were that chrome yellow, and that's where they got the nickname of the Gold Bug. Later Speedsters You know, they were coming in other colors. You could get any color that you wanted at, with Kissel. That was one of the things it was well known for. But Kissel, it was a convertible top with a speedster. Later ones did have a rumble seat and make it a four-passenger. Earlier ones had what was called an outrigger seat, where you slid those seats out. Don't know that that would be recommended because there really wasn't anything to hang on to. If you see our speedster here at the museum, it has those outrigger seats, and I don't know about that. But it was you know the low racy look to the car.
Was Studebaker made in Wisconsin?
No, Studebaker was made in South Bend, Indiana.
Okay, so I was just thinking of my Uncle Don's Studebaker President that he had. That was apparently a pretty sporty car back in the day. Do you have any Studebakers there?
We do. We have a couple of 1950 Studebakers. We have a 1947 dump truck and a beautiful 1937 Studebaker Dictator.
Yeah, I'm not sure what happened to Studebaker.
Yeah, well, Studebaker merged with Packard, and then the Packard name went away, and Studebaker continued on a little bit after that. But Studebaker has a great museum in South Bend. That's well worth a visit, too.
Debbie in DeSoto has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Debbie. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you. Growing up in Detroit in the 60s, my father was a machine tool engineer, and he had a job in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And I'd like to know if there was a car plant there, what was it, and is it still there, and if not, what happened to it?
Yeah, that was in the 60s, wasn't it, Debbie?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the 1960s, if it was Kenosha, he was likely working for American Motors, is what it would have been at that time. And American Motors, you know, morphed into, well, American Motors quit production in 1987, and then I'm not sure what's happened. I think most of those buildings that are Nash and American Motors related, a lot of those are gone. I don't know specifically what happened to each and every one of them, but I know a good number of them are gone, but a couple of them still survive down there.
Oh, interesting. Where were cars made? You said there were cars made in a lot of places in Wisconsin.
There were, all over the place. Most of the manufacturing was in southeastern Wisconsin, around the Milwaukee, Racine, Kenosha area, but other cars were made in Appleton and Green Bay, and some of these that were manufactured were very brief. They might have had only one or two model years, or even one model year where only a handful of examples were made.
Oh, very interesting. In your mind, what are the most interesting vehicles that you have at the museum?
Oh gosh, they've all got great stories, but one of them that has a great story is a 1950 Nash that we have, and that car is 75 years old and it has 61 miles on it because the woman who purchased it knew, planned to learn how to drive, and then didn't. That's the short version of the story. That explains the first 35 years of the car's life.
Oh my gosh.
So, that's very interesting. And Kissel was very innovative. Cadillac had the first electric start in 1912. Kissel had it by 1913. They had a lighted dash, by 1914. So, I just find that very, very interesting how advanced they were.
Yeah.
At the time.
At one point, you had a steam locomotive at the museum. Is it still there?
We do, yes. The 1913 number 1003 Soo Line steam locomotive. Yes, that you view from the second floor of the museum. And it typically goes out for Hartford's Christmas parade, and that's the second Saturday in November.
How do you decide which vehicles will go into the museum?
Some of it is simply a matter of space. Some of it is a matter of, whether we already have an example, if it's a duplicate. It's a big place, but space is still at a premium. And some of it, it's about, the story that goes with the car too. I mean, that can make a difference as well.
Well, they are really beautiful cars and trucks, and I mean the whole. To go to the museum and see these vehicles, and there's information. The stories are there as well.
Yes. Yep, there's a signboard for each vehicle, and we have QR codes on some of the signboards, and that's usually something extra about it, but it might be when a vehicle is out running in a parade or when it came to the museum, so that you get to see it moving and hear what it sounds like.
Marini in La Crosse emailed and said that she's never heard of the Kissel car, but she's reading a book that's based in Hartford in the Kissel plant.
Right.
It's Familiaris, I think it is.
Yes, and I am familiar with that book. It's historic, but not everything in there is accurate. That took place. So, and they tweak the name. They don't have it as Kissel Motor Car Company, which was the actual name of the company. I think they have it as Kissel Automobile Company. But yeah, but it's not surprising when people haven't heard of Kissel because it's been out of production for over 90 years now.
Yeah, no wonder.
And it wasn't being made by the millions like Chevy and Ford were at that same time.
Don in Cottage Grove has something. Let's go there. Hi, Don.
Yeah, hi. Real interesting subject here. Thanks for taking my call. My folks had I think it was a Nash Rambler, but one of the things that I didn't hear mentioned about what it was good for was the front seats folded down into the back seats, so teenagers really liked having their parents' car on certain occasions. I just wanted to bring that up.
And Don might have had some experience with that. I'm not going to ask him about it, but Don, what about it?
No, that is true. When you look at the late 40s and into the early 50s, that was one of the things that Nash talked about. And we have a video at the museum that you can view, and they were advertising it as, hey, this is a way to save on a motel room if you're out hunting or fishing, or it's easy to just stay in your car. Rather than someplace else, or if you have two people, one person can drive, one person can lay down flat and sleep because you could, you know, it was a split seat like that. And there were even accessories that came to help with you camping in your car. There were screens that fit over the windows so you could roll the windows down and keep the bugs out.
Oh, really interesting. Vivian in Green Bay, what's on your mind?
Recently, there have been a lot of shipwrecks discovered in Lake Michigan, and Tamara, she's with the Wisconsin Historical Society, leads a lot of those
Tamara
searches.
Thompson?
Hmm? Yeah, and I believe they found a ship that had many cars that were due for delivery, and I believe the Kissel was among the ones on that ship.
Right, well, I know Tamara, and she's been a speaker here at the museum. And you're talking about the Lakeland, and that ship went down in December of 1924, and it was loaded with 1925 models, and there was a mix of vehicles on there of Kissel, Rollin, and Nash automobiles. So we met with Tamara, it was probably about 10 years ago, and we're helping her identify which cars were which. Kissel versus Nash versus Rollin, and this was speculation on our part, but it seemed like there was one body style for each car, and there were double white wall tires, and we think that ship was probably heading to the Detroit Auto Show, which was going to take place in January of 1925.
Interesting. Vivian, thank you. And speaking of speakers, you have a speaker series again this starting up this fall. What are some of the topics?
We do. The first one is coming up on September 24th, What's Old is New Again, and that's a history of retro car design because, you know, we all see the influences of the past coming back in modern cars. And then we've also got Lights, Camera, Cars, Automobiles on the Big Screen. That's in October. And then we have Dual Emergence, The Birth of Automobiles and Advertising in November.
You know, they all sound like fun. How much is admission, by the way?
Admission for touring the museum is $12 for adults, $11 for seniors 65 and older.
All right. And adults are how old? Kids free?
Ages 6 to 16 are $6. 5 and under are free.
All right. And again, it's really worth it to take a look at your website. If you just type in Wisconsin Automotive Museum, you're going to get a lot of great photos and some stories connected with it, and learn more about how you can get there and also the costs, as Dawn just mentioned. Dawn, it's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, thank you, Larry. This has been fun.
It's been a lot of fun for me, and I'm sure it has been for our listeners as well. And we'll look forward. Hopefully we can get you back on again down the road here.
Okay.
Dawn Bond is Executive Director of the Wisconsin Automotive Museum, located in Hartford, Wisconsin. Lots of really interesting stories connected with with the museum and with the cars. I highly recommend you take a visit. And I want to thank you very much for joining us today. All of our shows are a team effort. We've got Clara Neipert and Joel Padnott, our producers, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I am Larry Mueller, and I thank you very much for listening, and I also invite you to stay tuned. Lots more in store here on WPR News.
And yell for me to hear, hey, buddy, how can I get this car?